I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Open phone lines this hour for reaction to the news from Washington and historic Supreme Court decision. The court ruled that the Constitution guarantees a nationwide right to same-sex marriage. We'll hear more about that from our guests and from Midday listeners. Also, in Annapolis yesterday, Governor Larry Hogan said no to the $2.9 billion Red Line, a 14-mile rail line connecting Baltimore's east and west sides, from Woodlawn to Bayview. WYPR senior news analyst Frazier Smith joins me to assess the ramifications of Hogan's decision. And we'll hear from University of Baltimore law professor Amy Dillard, who was at the Supreme Court this morning. Midday Friday, after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. I'm joined in Studio A this hour by C. Frazier Smith, the senior news analyst here at WYPR. A lot of news to analyze. Well, at least two major stories. One you just heard about, the Supreme Court decision this morning in same-sex marriage. And we were all set up also to talk about yesterday's decision here in Maryland by the governor of Maryland, Larry Hogan, announcing that he would not move forward with the Red Line rail project here in Baltimore and that the state would drastically reduce funding for the Purple Line down in Montgomery, Prince George's County, creating uncertainty about the future of that project. So, Frazier, welcome to the studio. Nice to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Dan.
I think we should start with the latest news, the Supreme Court ruling. This is a historic day, no doubt. You agree?
Absolutely. The Supreme Court reads the headlines.
Yeah.
We knew that, but again, we see it again.
Yeah. 36 states, it was already legal to be married for gay couples, lesbian couples to be married in 36 states, and this would end the ban in the 14 remaining states. Amy Dillard, law professor at the University of Baltimore, who's been doing a lot of work for us this week, was at the Supreme Court this morning and joins us now. Amy, welcome back to the show. Can you tell us a little bit about what you saw and heard down there today?
It was a fun day to be in court. It was a mostly packed courtroom. I was in the lawyer's seats. We went in as bar members and were actually sitting in the front row. Justice Stevens came in just before 10 o'clock and took a seat just to our right. I saw Justice Roberts' wife was there as well in the family seats. Courtroom was packed with a lot of people who have done a lot of work in the gay rights movement in the last 29 years since Bowers was decided. we all thought it would happen today because today's June 26th, and that's sort of become an important day. It's the day that Justice Kennedy read his decision in Lawrence in 2003, and in 2013, his Windsor decision. So we all sort of thought this might become sort of the day to close the book on these marriage cases.
Just do you mind recapping those two for us? I know 2013,
Windsor in 2013 is the first of the marriage cases.
Right.
And then in 2003, the court decided Lawrence versus Texas, which is when the court reversed its old decision from 1986 in Bowers. In 2003, the court held that intimate sexual activity between consenting same-sex adults could not be considered criminal conduct, that there's a right to privacy. So it was sort of the first important decision viewed gay people as having constitutional rights. In 1986, the court had said that there was no constitutional right of privacy to engage in homosexual conduct.
In 2011, President Obama reversed his position on the Defense of Marriage Act, too. That was also a critical step on the road to this decision today. And Amy, just a little bit more from you about the atmosphere down there once this decision was announced.
It was a big party. As those of us who had been in the courtroom, we were gathering our bags, and you could hear the shouting out in front of the courthouse and out on the steps. When we came out, my partner and I actually came out behind the plaintiffs, sort of like the Forrest Gump to history in this, but we came out behind the plaintiffs, and there's sort of a, you know, like a channel for us all to walk through between the crowd. People are taking pictures and banners, and the Gay Men's Chorus of Washington was singing, and there were press conferences happening everywhere. It was very, very joyful. Lots of babies, lots of balloons, you know, very joyful.
Amy, thank you very much for that report.
You're welcome, Dan. Have a good day.
You too. Amy Dillard of the University of Baltimore Law School. Now we switch to the University of Maryland Law School, and Mark Graber, Professor Mark Graber, who joins us to talk about Supreme Court decisions here on Midday, joining us now. Hello again, Mark.
Good to be here. Hello.
Mark, my question for you, is this ruling today, well, I guess it's a shock, a surprise. Does the scope of it surprise you?
Not really,
okay.
Because about 2 months ago, the court refused to stay an Alabama decision requiring same-sex marriage. And that was a fairly good hint that they were going to declare a right to same-sex marriage. Otherwise, what were you going to do with all Alabama couples who had been married for 2 months? Now, 4 years ago, if someone had said it's going to be 2015, that would have been the surprise. But I think most Supreme Court watchers, if they had to bet when the announcement came up, marriage cases, would have bet that Justice Kennedy would in fact find a constitutional right to marriage.
Let me quote some of Justice Kennedy's majority opinion on this, okay? Just take a minute here.
Yeah.
No union is more profound than marriage, for it embodies the highest ideals of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. In forming a marital union, two people become something greater than once they were. It would misunderstand these men and women to say they disrespect the idea of marriage. Their plea is that they do respect it so deeply that they seek to find its fulfillment for themselves. Their hope is not to be condemned to live in loneliness, excluded from one of civilization's oldest institutions. They ask for equal dignity in the eyes of the law. The Constitution grants them that right.
Well, I think the gist of the Kennedy opinion is that marriage is a very changing phenomenon, that what marriage was 300 years ago is not what marriage is today. And given what marriage is today, there is no reason to exclude same-sex couples from that institution.
Okay.
I think that's the basic argument of the opinion.
All right. Here's the dissent. Chief Justice Roberts in the dissent, along with Justice Scalia and Thomas. So that makes three. The fourth would be Alito, right?
Yeah.
Quote, if you are among the many Americans of whatever sexual orientation who favor expanding same-sex marriage, by all means celebrate today's decision. Celebrate the achievement of a desired goal. Celebrate the opportunity for a new expression of commitment to a partner. Celebrate the availability of new benefits, but do not celebrate the Constitution. It had nothing to do with it.
Well, I think that's at least wrong on one account in an important way. Namely, if you agree with the Supreme Court's precedents over the last 50 years, dating from the birth control case in Griswold, which are rooted in actually older law, then in fact the Supreme Court protects, or the Constitution, due process, one of your fundamental rights, are rights associated with family and procreation. So if you read the Roberts dissent, it sounds identical to the dissent, for example, in the abortion cases, only substituting same-sex marriage for abortion. If you believe the Supreme Court has a role in protecting what have become fundamental rights, then I think the Kennedy opinion follows. If you don't believe that role, then the Roberts opinion follows.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here. That's Mark Graber, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law. Our phone number for open phones this hour for your reaction to this news. Yeah, I guess I'm asking if are people surprised by this. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. You say the Supreme Court, Frazier Smith, reads the headlines.
Well, that's an old line.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think it it's widely known in the society that there's far more tolerance than there ever was before, and I think it grows from so many things. I mean, the former vice president's daughter was a lesbian, and mm-hmm. and is and proudly announces that. And then you have the hearings that I think have happened all over the country, and definitely in Maryland, where a lot of change happened for conservative voters who would have opposed this in the past. And for some reason, people got more focused on the actual human rights issues. And, you know, you knew people. There were people in your family who were outside. And why were they? And why were they not allowed to do as the Kennedy decision says, you know, come in and celebrate the new freedoms?
And there's 36 states already where it's legal. So the 14 remaining ones will not be able to enforce their bans. That's essentially what happened today, right, Mark Graber?
That's correct. States must allow same-sex couples to marry. There are still issues about, okay, whether the caterer has to serve the same-sex couple, but that's a separate issue.
Mark Graber, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Professor Mark Graber, University of Maryland Law School. 410-662-8780 is our phone number if you'd like to react to that news today from the Supreme Court. Also, we'll talk about the red line decision of Governor Larry Hogan not to fund the red line here in Baltimore. That was our intent for this hour, but this news from Washington and the Supreme Court certainly is something we want to talk about. We open the phone lines to you for your comments. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. We'll take our first break here, come back and talk to Frazier Smith about the red line situation and more on this decision of the Supreme Court. Also, a bit later on in the show today, we'll be talking about the Supreme Court decision with another University of Maryland law professor who just written a book about her own experiences in a same-sex marriage. An expert in family law will be joining us. And also, it's the 40th anniversary of Jaws, 1975, the summer of Jaws, Steven Spielberg's classic. Christopher Llewellyn Reed and Linda DeLibro, our midday film critics, will be here in the second hour to talk about Jaws. Welcome back to Midday. 410-662-8780. It's open lines on Midday Friday. Dan Roderick's here with C. Frazier Smith from the WYPR news staff, the senior news analyst here. So that expression, the Supreme Court reads the headlines, you know, 36 states have already made this legal, same-sex marriage. So does that mean 100 years ago, had there even been such a challenge brought to the Supreme Court, assuming someone could even get such a case to the Supreme Court 100 years ago, we wouldn't have seen this decision because the country wasn't moving in this direction. Therefore, it makes it sound like the Supreme Court is merely reflective of representative of popular opinion. Is that right?
Well, no, of course not.
But it might be.
Yes and no, right, Dan? I mean, you know,
to say the Supreme Court justices aren't influenced by public opinion?
Well, I think they are, but I think, you know, the sampling that you just gave us of the prevailing opinion and the dissenting one shows you that there was a debate and a discussion within the context of the law and the Constitution, and there were different views of it. Mm-hmm. But to think that they're not influenced by what people out in the world believe, I just think is probably not realistic.
410-662-8780. So let's take some calls on this. We'd love to hear what people have to say about the Supreme Court ruling today. Dave in Baltimore, you're our first caller on this. Hello.
Hi there. I'm 67. I knew I was gay in high school. I never told a single human person until I was in college. And in the early 50s, when I was in Southern California, the police were still driving paddy wagons up to gay bars and taking all the people in the gay bar and put them in jail. And now, here at age 67, the Supreme Court says that all states have to allow gay marriage. It's pretty amazing change. Pretty amazing. And I was just talking to a gay friend of mine who's the same age, and I realized that no other generation in the past or in the future of gay people will ever see such an amazing change in their lifetime. So it's a pretty amazing time to be alive as a gay person.
Yeah. It is pretty quick. I'm glad you called, Dave. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I mean, just a few years ago in Maryland, we were talking about civil unions, right? Yes, we had a judge's ruling in Baltimore City that was highly controversial. A Democrat governor who said he didn't support gay marriage, but he supported civil unions. And then he took a few more years to come around to that. And then we had a vote, actually had a, was put out a referendum, a challenge to the legislature's passage of it. Remember?
I do
remember. It was historic. Right? And so people actually voted.
And it was one of the first states to approve it by vote, by referendum.
Right. And that all happened fairly quickly.
Well, I mean, take the case of the president of the United States. What did he say? That his position on it was evolving.
Yeah, right, right. 410.
He was reading the headlines, too.
Right. Here's Josh in Baltimore. 410-662-8780. Josh, go right ahead with your comments.
Hi. So I'm just really happy about this right now. I'm a psych student currently, and I've been studying abnormal psych for the past half a year. And one of the things that they teach you is homosexuality and those kind of things were considered a mental illness until just a few decades ago. So this whole decision kind of, I just want to point out how it shows human progress and how, you know, we will change as time goes on. And I wasn't even surprised that this happened. You know, like this whole thing is just some great example of human progress and human evolution and everything like that.
I guess I'm not surprised, but it is this Supreme Court. It is the John Roberts Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia, Clarence Thomas, Alito Supreme Court. Let's not forget that. Yeah. Yeah. I'm talking about the lack of surprise.
Oh, yes. I'm not surprised.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm surprised that you're surprised, actually.
No, but I'm saying this is a conservative Supreme Court. It's a 5-4 decision.
Sure, you're right.
All well, right. If not for Kennedy, it wouldn't have happened.
But, well, we're seeing it over and over, right? I mean,
you want to talk about the red line? You want to move on to that?
Let's do.
All right. We'll talk about the red line here, but it doesn't mean we won't take calls about the Supreme Court decision. Those are the two things on our lunch table today for a conversation, the Supreme Court ruling, and then this decision yesterday by Governor Larry Hogan, much anticipated announcement that he would not move forward with the Red Line project in Baltimore. This is a $2.9 billion 14-mile rail line that was supposed to connect Baltimore's east side with the west side, Woodlawn to Bayview through downtown Baltimore. It's been in the planning stages for at least a decade. The new governor comes in a short time in office, 6 months in office or so, says no to the red line. And then on the purple line, which has been, I guess, planned even longer down in the Washington suburbs, he's saying he's drastically reducing the state's part of funding the purple line and putting that on Prince George's and Montgomery counties. Rick Seltzer is joining us from the Baltimore Business Journal for this segment of the show to talk about this. Rick, nice to see you. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Frazier, first, your reaction on this. What did you think?
We're in the context of surprise, and I'm not surprised because he said essentially during the campaign that he thought it was more than we could afford and something that he was against. And I remember asking one of the lobbyists in Annapolis if he thought, you know, 3 months ago, if it was dead. Even as the new transportation secretary was reviewing it all, and he said, "Absolutely, it is dead." And I, you know, who knows exactly why? Except there's lots of speculation that this is about directly to his base, which tends to be pretty car dependent and rural
suburban.
And suburban,
yeah.
Exactly,
and not interested in public transportation generally.
Yes, and yeah. You know, and I think again he promised to cut spending, and he's referred to this project as a boondoggle, which I just don't quite understand because I think it.
What does the term boondoggle connote? Corruption,
wasteful spending,
spending and corruption.
Right.
Somebody benefiting from something that isn't needed. Right.
Well, and I think definitely you could argue that it's needed, and I mean you could argue at the same time that maybe it's too expensive for us. But to say that it's not needed doesn't wash. I think,
Rick, the business community in the Baltimore area generally had lined up behind this, right?
That's absolutely right. The CEO of the Greater Baltimore Committee, Don Fry, had really pushed for this over several years, and I believe the GBC pushed for it dating back to the initial planning stages in, I think it was 2002 when this actually was starting to take effect. Yesterday he said there's no plan B. I think everyone right now is wondering what to do. I talked to the city's transportation director, William Johnson, this morning, and he told me that there are no replacement projects in line. He's going to meet with the state in mid-July. Maybe we'll find a way forward after that.
Some 9,000 jobs were to have been created. That was the estimate, right?
I believe that's right.
For the construction of the Red Line.
There was construction. The overall economic impact numbers I saw were about $3 billion were what the estimates were.
And Frazier, in doing this, the governor is saying goodbye possibly to lots of federal money.
$900 million is on the table, and he's decided that somehow or another it's not worth it to the state of Maryland to take that. It's just going to cost too much more. The problem, of course, is that you were in line to get grants like this for a long time. You're at the head of the line. Suddenly you're at the back of the line. So the idea that we might not ever see this, in the near future is quite real.
We'd like to hear from our listeners your reaction to the governor's decision on the Red Line, 410-662-8780. I keep putting out that number because they have open phone lines, and also we're talking about the Supreme Court ruling this morning on gay marriage. I want to keep our listeners involved in that and engaged in this. Let's go to Daniel in Hamden for his comments. Hamden's Daniel. Well, go right ahead, please.
Hi. My husband and I, we actually got married by the mayor during Gay Pride in 2013, the year after Maryland voted it in. And he was of a generation that never thought that marriage would happen. He just wanted to be alone, be left alone, like not get arrested or anything like that. But me being a millennial, was more the mindset, it's going to happen and we're going to have to fight for it. And we did.
You did. We did. And you won. And,
oh, yeah.
And so today, how does this feel to you today? It's a historic day because they're saying the Constitution, the Supreme Court is saying the Constitution guarantees this right to anyone throughout the country. But it sort of completes, I guess that completes the story, doesn't it?
Well, it completes a chapter because we still have to do a lot of advancement for transgender rights and bisexual rights and also asexual rights as well. There's a lot of rainbows in the LGBTQIA community as well. So we still have a lot of stuff to do, and we are advancing, like with Caitlyn Jenner, but there's still a lot of people that are killed all the time because they're trans.
Daniel, thanks for calling.
All right. Have a good day.
Good day. A moment ago, Rick Seltzer mentioned Don Fry of the Greater Baltimore Committee, and we asked Don Fry for his comments today about Governor Hogan's decision on the Red Line, so we'll go back to that subject now. Don Fry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan.
So the GBC had lined up in support of the Red Line. You thought this would be good for economic development in Baltimore.
Yeah, GBC has been supporting the Red Line since early 2000s, around 2002. We think it would have been a significant investment in Baltimore's future, a great opportunity for employment, both not only through the construction phase, but also access to employment for many people who don't have that access currently in parts of the city.
Well, are you surprised by this decision? Were you prepared for this?
Yeah, I don't think you're ever prepared for a major disappointment like this. We certainly, when we got the word, we're very disheartened, I think very frustrated, because a lot of work has gone into this. We were one of only six projects that have been identified and have gone through the federal process that makes you eligible for federal monies. And by pulling the rug out from under that, that certainly puts us in a situation that it's unlikely that Baltimore will have a chance for major or mass transit improvements for close to a decade.
Boy. You know, when the governor withdrew this, said he wouldn't support it, he didn't really put anything in its place except highway projects around the state. He didn't put anything in its place in terms of mass transit, improving the MTA, for instance. We just had a report from the Baltimore Metropolitan Council, the Opportunity Collaborative, that report, I think Rick's familiar with that, saying that people have a tough time getting to jobs, people who don't have cars, who live in the inner city, for instance, and rely on public transportation. It takes them too long to get to work. Got to do something about it. Got to better connect people. And there's nothing here like that that's suggested.
You have empty nesters, and you have millennials who tend not to be as car-centric and car-dependent as we are, all living along that route, which now gets withdrawn from them. And people are saying, you know, this is the strength of the city. This is the new, strong, vibrant downtown core. And they're left with the transportation system that we have and not the one that we could have had.
Don, was the governor hearing?
Yeah, I think the number was about 28% of the residents in the Red Line corridor don't own cars. And in some of those neighborhoods, it's as high as 70%. So clearly would have been a great way for people to have access to jobs that they currently don't have that opportunity, or it's very difficult for them to get to those employment opportunities.
Don, where did you hear resistance? Where was the resistance coming from? I heard it from Canton, some people in Canton. Where else? Was this just the governor's thinking, my base isn't interested in this. I wasn't sent to Annapolis to fund these two big projects.
Well, I've been involved in some capacity on major transportation projects for over 20 years, when my days in the legislature and then after. And there's always opposition to any major transportation project. There was some opposition in the Canton area, but I think that overwhelmingly people were supportive of the Red Line. This is, again, I think it's a decision that was the governor's. I don't necessarily agree with the – first of all, I don't agree with the decision. I don't agree with the justification. He's referred to this as a boondoggle. Projects like this that have been in existence and planned for 10 or more years and go through all those federal processes and ultimately get approved and funding by the federal government are not boondoggles. That's what the process is for, is to wean out those types of projects. So there's not a fatal flaw in this project, except for the fact that I guess the governor doesn't feel he wants to spend that type of money on this project.
Now, is there any hope to go back to the governor and convince him again, or do you at least plan on trying to do that?
Well, I think a number of us are talking about what other potential options we have, but this is a situation that unfortunately the governor has a lot of control over, and we're going to have to strategize and figure out what steps, if any, we can take. But there is no plan B as far as another rail or mass transit option. This was the one that had been decided on a long time ago. This is the alternative that made the most sense and had the best likelihood to be approved by the federal government. But there is no fallback position on any plan. We're going to be basically starting from the beginning if the Red Line is dead.
And one last question for you, Don. The governor mentioned the tunnel, or his transportation secretary mentioned the tunnel part of the Red Line as being the part that made it impractical.
It was interesting to hear that, because the governor also mentions the fact that Baltimore has a terrible record with existing light rail system as far as efficiency and ridership. Arguably, part of that is because it's on surface. And because it's on surface, it has to stop at every one of the lights and obviously has to deal with existing traffic. Tunneling avoids that hassle. When you're dealing with a major urban area, when you have the condensed areas like we have in Baltimore City, tunneling is the best option and would help from speed, also helps as far as ridership to an extent, and also helps to the rest of the traffic congestion on the major downtown thoroughfares. Only one-third, or less than one-third of this entire line, the 14.1-mile line, only less than 4 miles of this, or roughly 4 miles of it, was tunneled. So less than a third of it was even going to be tunneled to begin with.
Don, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Dan.
Don Frey of the Greater Baltimore Committee. Where did you hear the resistance, Rick Seltzer?
I think absolutely the Canton area is probably one of the places that you heard it coming from. The fact that it was going to be above ground there actually may have caused some of that resistance.
In Boston Street.
That's right. By and large, outside of resistance, though, I think in large part in some of the core constituencies, at least that were electing Republican legislators, I heard a lot of indifference to whether it was built. And maybe that led to some resistance. Because, frankly, a lot of the people I was talking to in the legislature were saying, well, we've been shut out of a lot of state highway funding lately, so why does Baltimore get this giant transit project when our counties aren't getting money to build roads?
But they have in the past. This thing's been in the works 10 or 12 years, though. Same thing with the Purple Line. We're going to take some more calls on this subject, the Red Line. We will do that in a minute. I just want to welcome Lisa Polyak on the show, because She and her wife were lead plaintiffs in that case I talked about earlier that goes back, how many years now, Lisa? What year was that with Judge Murdoch? Lisa, you there? Oh, did we lose her? Oh, I'm very sorry. That's Lisa Polyak. She was a plaintiff in that case along with her wife, and she called in to comment on the Supreme Court decision. Well, I'm sorry about that. Well, maybe she'll call back. But Stuart, let's hear from you on this very quickly, and then we'll take our little break here. Stuart, go right ahead. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So quickly, I'm not surprised by the decision. I'm very happy about it. But I just want to sort of point out for discussion that now that the marriage right has been confirmed, confronting the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender community is the issue of employment discrimination. And so I hope that our community focuses its efforts there moving forward.
Okay. Thank you very much for that comment. We'll take some additional comments on that. And the red line, folks have lined up to comment on the Governor Hogan's decision on the red line, so we'll get to those after this short break here on Midday. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Rick Seltzer from the Baltimore Business Journal and C. Fraser Smith of the WYPR news staff in the studio with me. We'll be right back. More Midday Friday ahead. We'll speak to Martha Ertman, a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law and an expert in family law, about today's Supreme Court ruling. Plus, Midday film critics Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed look back to 1975 when Steven Spielberg's Jaws arrived in theaters. More Midday Friday after the news at 1. Email from a listener, David, in Baltimore City. This red line decision by Governor Hogan, along with the $11.6 million cut to Baltimore schools, just goes to show that his quote-unquote commitment to Baltimore after the so-called riots only lasted for as long as the national media was here. Now that they are gone, he is back to treating Baltimore as the hopeless place that many people in the surrounding suburbs see it as. And a question from Chris by email. Assuming the city could raise $700 million in funding for the red line on its own, a big if granted, could the Maryland Department of Transportation be cut out of the process? Could this project potentially live on as a collaboration between Baltimore City and Baltimore County? Would that imperil federal subsidies? A question for our guests. Rick Seltzer, you want to take that one?
I don't know about federal subsidies, but I do know that it would be an awful lot of money for the city and Baltimore County, which has also pledged some money to the project, to come up with. The city, the original red line cost was $2.6 billion. It ballooned a little to $2.9 billion by the time we're talking about it today. The city was on the hook for $230 million pledged. The county was $50 million. And then the federal government was $900 million. If you do the math quickly, that leaves an awful lot of money that you would have to raise. The state's somewhere in the range of $1.5 to $1.8 billion, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of money for Baltimore City, which, let's face it, isn't in the greatest financial shape all the time. If you compare it to other areas of the state, it's not that feasible.
A question from Steve in Baltimore. Steve, you're up next. Go right ahead with your question about this. Hi.
Hey. How's it going? I was wondering if when the General Assembly comes back in January, would they be able to overturn this at all? I mean, it just seems like everything progressive that Maryland's trying to do, Larry Hogan just wants to slash it and bring us back to the 1960s where mass transit is horrible and he's just looking out for the fossil fuel industries. It just baffles me that with these decisions, especially after the riot. And I'll take my comment up there. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, the Assembly can do little to combat this, although the Assembly did foresee that it might happen and passed some sort of a restriction on how the money could be spent. It can only be, as in the school situation, what they did was limit the money to, I guess, just its original purpose, for this man's mass transit project.
And that limitation, I actually was talking to DOT officials about that today. I think it's about $60 million that would have been spent on the project this year at the state level. And but that the DOT believes that expires, that limitation expires at the end of this year. In other words, the money then goes back out of its pen and may be able to be reallocated. It'll be interesting to see, I think, what the legislature does going forward if they try to find a way to continue to restrict that.
This is reminiscent of a decision that Chris Christie made in New Jersey to turn down billions, I think, in federal funds for a new tunnel system between New York and New Jersey, even though the state had already spent hundreds of millions of dollars in studying it. And that's the case here. Many millions of dollars have already been spent studying and designing the Red Line, right?
Absolutely. And not just studying and designing, but there was some purchasing going on already, too. The city had spent about $5 million into the project to date. That's money that they'd actually paid out, I believe. They invested it. And I was at a state spending meeting in January when they were moving ahead with purchasing land and easements. This was for both the Purple and Red Line, but the line item on that agenda was $5.1 million just for that particular meeting. So there have been millions of dollars that, in actual real property that have been purchased for this.
Let's take a couple more calls here. Julia in Towson, go right ahead. Hi.
Hi there. I'm from Towson, and I am a millennial who was thinking about moving to Baltimore after I finished college. And if there's no Red Line, I don't know how I feel about it, because I am a very environmentally conscientious person, and I would like to live in a place where I wouldn't need to have a car because of the amount of pollution that comes from that. And I also worry about living in a socially just city where everyone has access to transportation and jobs. And so I worry that without the Red Line and without good public transportation, Baltimore is not going to be able to attract young professionals.
I'm glad you called, Julia, that we get that point of view in here. It's not, as John Fry was saying, it's not just the people we, usually think of as using public transportation. Public transportation is part of the future. It should be seen that way. It is a green system. It's ideal, right? That's part of the reason you do it, to reduce traffic congestion, the amount of fossil fuels that are burned in our area. Even Kevin Kamenetz, the Baltimore County executive, made that point in his response to this.
You know, Dan, we're talking here about various alternatives and ways around this and whether or not it could be reversed, and it probably can't. And we need to recognize, I think, that this is an incredible body blow to the city. I went around a couple of months ago, actually almost a year ago, with Jay Brody and looked at parts of the city that were prospering, doing well.
Former president of the Baltimore Development Corporation.
Right. And he really thought of the Red Line as the city's lifeline, something that would show the ball. Following on the caller's comments about a progressive and nimble and in some ways daring city. If you aren't willing to invest in the future, and that's what this really is.
Yeah.
Then what do you have? And everybody knows how much what severe problems Baltimore faces.
And one of them is a transit system that is not connected enough.
Correct.
Not well connected.
And it's not just the city either. It's regional connections that would happen if you suddenly you had, east-west and not just north-south.
Rick, that Opportunity Collaborative made the point about how the job centers aren't actually in Baltimore. They're outside of Baltimore, but there are people in Baltimore who need to get to them.
That's right, and it can be very hard, even within the city, to get from one side of the city to another. We talk about Amazon and its new 1,500-job warehouse. That collaborative project, that planning project, had a series of maps in it that showed as you shift farther away from, they used the Amazon and the port area as a ground zero. And once you get out of a very immediate range there aren't a lot of transit connections. Coming from the east side can take several transfers. It can take, I think it was upwards of 90 minutes, depending on where you're living. Having said that, I do think it's important. I've heard some things from the business community that I should have mentioned, and that is there's a sense that the original light rail line, the north-south light rail line, killed a lot of development and or retail along Howard Street. I don't know how much development it actually killed and how much of that is just past perception. But I think there may have been some concern that about that in the Canton area, at least, that something similar would happen there.
And also people look at that system and say, well, if the red line is going to be like that system, it's slow and it's clunky. But I think that's the reason why they put the tunnel in, right?
Well, and one of the Canton Crossing development down there, the people that developed that project were hoping that it would come. They thought it was going to help them.
It's a great point. There are a lot of development projects that actually retooled slightly so that they could accommodate the red line or were built around it, yes.
Marty Taylor has been on our show. Marty Taylor is opposed to the red line. He's part of the Right Rail Coalition and came in here. We spent an hour with Marty some time ago. So, Marty, I guess thanks for joining us. I guess you're pleased with the governor's decision on this.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for having me. I am pleased with the governor's decision. I think I agree with the governor on two points. The governor said that this project was too expensive, and he said that it wasn't effective. It made no sense from a transit or financial perspective. And I think the point that people miss is that there's a huge perception that this was a high-speed subway line, and it just isn't. So the problem is that we were going to spend all this money, and then the project that we were going to get wasn't going to do what everybody thought.
Okay. I don't know anybody who – I haven't heard anybody describe it as a high-speed subway line. Only the part that's in a tunnel, one would assume because it's in a tunnel for a piece of it, that's more efficient than the above-ground system. But it comes in from the west side where streetcars used to run along Edmondson Avenue. It makes use of the highway to nowhere on the east side and the Franklin-Mulberry corridor, and then it comes downtown and goes underground at some point. But Marty, I don't know anybody who thought it was going to be a high-speed subway system.
Well, I think the problem is that the hype around the project and what people said it was going to do and what it would actually do were dramatically different. The project runs at best at about 18 miles an hour. The city buses run 11, 12, 13 miles an hour. So by the time you get off your bus and transfer to the red line, and then in many cases get off the red line again and transfer to another bus, people that were transit dependent weren't saving time. In fact, they were seeking more time. And the project in that way had been kind of a white elephant for some time. There's a very excellent article in The Brew today talking about how we got here and how this project did become a boondoggle. I agree with the governor on that point as well, because what happened was you're paying tunnel prices for a surface capacity and slow system. And if that's supposed to be the backbone of a transit system for a city, you're never going to work. It's never going to work. It doesn't get people where they wanted to go better than where they were getting without it being built. And transit times, traffic and congestion were all mentioned. If the system worked, we would actually have faster transit times and decreased congestion. But the MTA's own study shows that traffic got worse in the city if it was built. That just didn't make any sense.
Okay, Marty. Well, thank you for joining us today. Marty Taylor of the Right Rail Coalition, which opposed the red line. I went to Hunt Valley the other day. You know how I went to Hunt Valley? I took the number 8 bus on York Road to Lutherville. I waited 16 minutes for a light rail train, and it took me up to Hunt Valley. I didn't use my car. The whole thing cost me $3.20, maybe a little more than that, $3.40 maybe. I don't know. But I didn't use my car. I didn't have to park a car. Then they got back in the right in the light rail, and then it went home. And it wasn't a big hassle. And it wasn't maybe slower than it would have been in my car, maybe, but I read the newspaper. Anyway, just wanted to say that. For those of you who never try it or think it's too slow, actually works for me. Not all the time, but most of the time. Laurel Mendez is out in Edmondson Village. Vice President of the Edmondson Village Community Association decided to call in today and tell us give us Laurel's reaction. Hello, Laurel.
Hello, thank you.
What did you say about this? Are you pleased or not pleased about this?
First of all, I want to thank you for doing this on your show. And second of all, the whole neighborhood association is absolutely devastated. Our president talked to the Sun yesterday and said she was not only disgusted by this as well as disappointed. This is terrible for our neighborhood. The improvements to the neighborhood, the transit-oriented development that was going to be planned and was going to occur around the red line is just I mean, it's not just the jobs on the red line that are lost. It's the jobs that all of that development and the jobs that would result from it that we're losing. And it's a terrible, terrible loss.
When you say transit-oriented development, what did you anticipate out along Edmondson Village?
Well, our neighborhood has been advocating for the Red Line since 2005. We have been a staunch promoter of the Red Line and an ally to anyone who was willing to work for it. The plan that the MTA had is, with the Red Line going through, they were going to have to do some regrading of people's front yards and repairing of people's front porches. They were going to take maybe 10 inches of sidewalk, yes, but they were going to repair all the sidewalk along the route and regrade several miles of front yards and repair porches. There were going to be businesses that would receive benefit and that would spring up along the line. And, of course, the village itself would have been improved in terms of its appearance and perhaps in the quality of the stores it rents to.
Laurel, thank you for calling in with that. Laurel Mendez, Vice President of the Edmondson Village Community Association. And we heard a lot about this. Actually, advocates were saying, Rick Seltzer, you know, it's not just a transit line. There's an opportunity for development along this line in places where there is, you know, minimal or no development now.
Right. Development, and I think kind of spreading from some of the job centers. You know, this was supposed to start out in Woodlawn, which is where the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services is located. That's 16,000 people work there, according to Kevin Kamenetz. And then the idea, I think, being that it spreads all throughout the line and you can get people working in different places. Again, it's that tension between what happened with the original North-South Light Rail line, and that has never really developed around that in many places, and what was being projected and being pushed to happen here.
Well, there were supposed to be 19 stations, right?
Stations, right, yeah.
And some development was expected around all of those.
Mm-hmm. Grant Corley is a founding member of Red Line Now, has been pushing for this for some time. Grant must be very disappointed with this decision. Were you surprised?
I can't say that I was surprised. I was outraged, and I really felt insulted, really, for the people of Baltimore. But, you know, we've had a feeling something like this has been coming for a while. A lot of people at Red Line Now have actually felt that the support from some of our elected officials has been rather tepid. Not everybody, but that gets a little scary when you're talking about building a large infrastructure project. It makes it easier for the governor, Governor Hogan, to go ahead and cancel the project. It gives him cover when there's not united political support for this project. And I do think that this goes back to, I think there's a cultural problem in Baltimore where, and you guys have touched on it today, that public transit is seen in Baltimore as something largely to be used by the poor. And it's important for the poor, and it's great. But a public transportation system shouldn't be something that's segregated. You know, it needs to be integrated. We live in a very segregated city. And I really think that the Red Line was one of the few progressive projects I've seen in Baltimore that actually would have brought people in our city together. So I'm very frustrated. And members of Red Line Now are very frustrated about this announcement.
And down the road in the Purple Line, you got to look at that and wonder, can Montgomery County, Prince George's County come up with the money the governor says they have to come up with now to make this? I mean, yeah. he might have effectively killed both projects yesterday.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Did you touch on the question today? I apologize, I missed the very beginning because I'm a working stiff. Did you touch on the question as to whether Secretary Ron really did review the Red Line?
Yeah,
because
it makes you suspicious, doesn't it? I mean, it does say he came into office in what, February? Yeah, I know what you're saying, Grant. Yeah, now we got to dig into this a little bit more. Thank you. We're short of time now, but Grant, maybe we'll take this up again another day. Even though it may seem like a dead issue, there are some questions about what the legislature could do here, if anything. So anyway, thanks for being here, Rick Seltzer from the Baltimore Business Journal. The BBJ, the print edition of the BBJ is out today. Oh, it got a cover story on McCormick. McCormick made a big acquisition this week, too, didn't it?
That's right. They bought the owner of a barbecue sauce maker in Texas, Stubbs.
Stubbs, yeah. I like Stubbs' barbecue sauce. So anyway, Rick, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Cover story in the BBJ today on McCormick Spice. And Fraser Smith, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure as always, Dan.
And thank you, everybody who called in. Have an interesting conversation coming up. One more conversation about today's Supreme Court ruling in the second hour of our show. And then we celebrate the 40th anniversary of The Big Shark. In 1975, Steven Spielberg's Jaws, looking at 40 years since then with our film critics, Chris Reed and Linda DeLibero.